Welcome to this week's episode of the First Move podcast. This week we're talking to Martijn Cox, co-founder and head of technology at Celtis. From PhD project to 160 million euros in funding, Martijn Cox has helped turn an academic idea into a groundbreaking medtech company. Celtis is redefining how vascular implants are made, and they're now on the brink of launching their first product. In this episode, we dive into the remarkable journey of Celtis, how it spun out from a PhD program, scaled to a team of 60 plus, and attracted top-tier investors. If you're curious about how to turn deep science into real-world impact, this is an episode you won't want to miss. So give it a listen. Martijn, thank you for coming on the podcast today. Could you please introduce yourself a little bit and what you do at Celtis?
Sure. So I'm Martijn Cox. I'm head of technology at Celtis. I'm also one of the founders of Celtis. And what we do is we make heart valves and blood vessels that, when we implant them, they are polymer pieces of plastic, but over time, these products fill with cells from the patient's own body. These cells fill the pores in our implants with natural tissue. So over time, our polymeric implants transform into living patient-owned blood vessels or heart valves.
And how did you actually get started working on this in the first place? Because it's a pretty crazy and unique concept. So what did the start of that look like?
Yeah, so the start of that, well, that's a long story. It's a long start. So actually, I studied biomedical engineering at the University of Eindhoven. And there was already a research program on making tissue-engineered heart valves and blood vessels. So the idea that you would actually use a bioreactor in the laboratory, you would take cells from a patient, seed them on a temporary scaffold, and then in the bioreactor we call that fitness for cells. So you would train them to become strong and make tissue, and in the end make a living heart valve or blood vessel. And that was there for years. And I was really fascinated by the idea that you can kind of rebuild the human body. So when the opportunity arose to do a PhD research in that topic, I joined. So I joined that research group. There were many PhDs there already. After a few years, there was an opportunity, and maybe we'll talk about that later, to actually start a company from that bigger research. And I grabbed that opportunity, and fast forward another few years, and now we're here today.
Very cool. And so you started off doing this research on essentially building the scaffolding and training the cell fitness. Now, I mean, this is primarily, we're curious about the business and how that came to life. Mm-hmm. So how did that translation then go?
Yeah, so the, let's say the starting story for our company today is I still remember very well. I was at an airport in Milano, together with my professor at the time. And my professor came off the phone and he said, "Oh, we got X million euros of funding. But now I need to start a company." Because he got the funding for working with a company. Yeah. And I thought, hey, that's interesting. So I made sure I was in his car when we kind of moved from that airport to the conference or something we were going towards. And I said, okay, if you're going to start a company, I would love to be the person that starts that company. Because I was always been very interested in entrepreneurship, and I didn't know if I could really do that myself, start a company. But the idea of trying, at least, I was very mesmerized by that. So I thought, hey, now I need to make sure I put up my finger. And that's what started the company. Initially, there was some money. The professor, of course, wanted to help as many patients as possible, but on the shorter term, to have a company to be able to get those public funding and grants for his research was the primary drive. So that's where the seed was first planted.
Cool.
So the name of the company is Celtis. Mm-hmm. Is there a story behind the name Celtis?
There is. It's it's not a fantastic story. So actually, the company that I founded initially was called Cutis, and it's merged after a few years with a Swiss startup company that was called Celtis. So my company was a spin-off from the University of Eindhoven. Celtis was a spin-off from the University Hospital of Zurich. And those university research groups were already working together, and they all had their own little startups. They were kind of destined to somehow come together. QTIS is short for Quality Tissue Engineering. Celtis is short for Excellent Tissue Engineering. So I can't make it really better than that. When we merged, I proposed at some point maybe we should call us Executis, but that didn't make it. So we ended up with Celtis, and I think that was a smarter choice.
And so, you have now Celtis, or you were there at the beginning when it was still QTIS.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a few years into your PhD, right?
Correct.
That your professor got the phone call and saying you need to start a business. Then, you've done all this research around these processes using these polymers as scaffolding. How do you then start to translate that into building a business case around it and saying, okay, now we will have this funding. If we do this, how can we start that process? What did that look like for the project?
Yeah, so, the first thing was to try and build/write that business case. There was quite some opportunity at the time to apply for public funding. That was really for collaboration between universities and startups. So that was the initial target, to apply for that funding, to also make use of the excellent name that the research group had that we came from. And that allowed us to secure quite some non-dilutive funding to get us started. At the same time, we were setting up a small production facility to make the heart valves, but primarily initially it was mainly heart valves that we were making, to produce these for the animal studies that you inevitably need to get these kind of products on the market. And those things kept us pretty busy. So it's really kind of getting some money and doing the more basic research that we believed would be necessary anyway to get there in the end.
Right. So it was still very much within the frame of research at this phase.
Correct.
Yeah. And how long did that continue for? How many years spanned over that process?
Yeah. So I think where the big switch, so we started in 2007, so that's quite some time ago. And the first 2-3 years was really kind of getting some money, also finishing the PhD at the, on the side. We also did a master in business innovation, all sharpening that business case. Things really got fast forwarded when QTIS and Celtis met and decided that it made more sense to join forces. And then we merged. We suddenly had a Swiss headquarters and an R&D facility in the Netherlands. And then from that point, I also had a CEO, I had a boss, and we had some investors behind the company. So that's kind of naturally, I said, this business aspect. We naturally had that. We had our R&D better in order. They, Celtis, Switzerland, had the business side better in order. So that was, for me, that was an obvious choice to join forces and make us some better than the individual parts.
And talking about the business side of things, how does the business model look, or how is it going to look when it's readily available for sale? Is it that you're going to make it in bulk, or is it an individualized part that you make for a patient that needs it?
So what we do, we produce the... So maybe I should also say, I initially talked about culturing living cells and tissues in a laboratory. Around the time we had that merger, we also decided to change that. We had learned so much on how this worked that we felt, we believe we now knew what the material needed to have as properties to allow us to kind of skip the bioreactor step and implant our product without cells immediately into the body, and then use the body as a bioreactor, basically. And let's say the big advantage is that you make the regulation much simpler. You are making a medical device and not a cell-based product. That was a very first step that we made. So today we have a clean room where we have an ISO certification to allow us to produce medical implants. And say, contrary to what you might think, there is no need to kind of make a patient-specific heart valve or a patient-specific blood vessel. You need to make it with a certain diameter. And for heart valves, we make them in several different diameters, but that's it. Okay. So there is no patient three-dimensional scan or something, and then, okay, this means this is the exact product you need to make. There is more standardization in that than you would think, maybe.
And so, I mean, that's quite a big switch going from needing to first have the cells grow on the actual implant to now going to this. I think it's also quite a big innovation, and probably what set Celltis apart is having this transformative vascular implant, essentially. How does it work, simply put? How do you implant this? Do you take out part of the blood vessel and then put it in? Do you stitch it in as if you're the surgeon? How does that process actually look like inside the human body when someone gets one of your implants?
Oh, that's a good question. So in principle, our blood vessel or vascular graft, it handles the same way as a common synthetic vascular graft, so as a common artificial blood vessel. So like a surgeon would normally do, they would kind of unpack it, they would kind of cut it to size, they would will suture it to the native blood vessels that it needs to bypass or connect or whatever the exact application is. And so there, for the surgeon, there is hardly any difference. The main difference is that once implanted, our product has a very porous structure. Mm. So if you put it in a microscope, you see all these little holes. And we made that microstructure in a specific way that the pores are big enough for cells to be able to really grow in, to permeate the wall of our implants and nest there. So and then cells, what do cells do? They start to filling those pores with tissue to make of their own. I always say it's a bit like when you have a cut in your hands. This cut normally heals, unless it's a very deep cut, then maybe you get a scar. Mm. So what our scaffolds do is they give those cells a microenvironment in which they can heal and not make a scar. So what you have left in the end is, and so all those holes are filled with new patient-owned natural tissue. And at the same time, our material is designed to bioabsorb. So over time, actually, it's signals that the cells send out that gradually make the material fade away.
Mm. And you use electrospinning to make these scaffoldings. Why electrospinning? Is that the most efficient way to do it, or is that just because you can get it super, super thin with electrospinning?
Actually, it's both.
Okay.
So we had learned from our lab work like what kind of microstructure we needed, and so an electrospinning is one of the common ways of achieving that. People nowadays also use 3D printing. Electrospinning is a kind of 3D printing. It's a bit less controlled in where exactly you put your individual fiber. But because of that, it's also much faster. So although 3D printing today got better in resolution, it was not good enough when we started. Still, electrospinning is a much quicker way of building a full implant. Well, I should say that one thing that we did different from everybody else, at the time at least, is when people were using electrospinning, they were trying to use that to mimic the nanostructure that is typical for what's called the extracellular matrix, the environment that is around cells. So people were trying to get smaller and smaller, really make fibers that are kind of that have diameters in the nanometer range. And we quickly realized that range doesn't give you enough porosity for cells to grow in. So we deliberately went a bit higher, up to the micro, And that is one of the things that we realized among the first that gave us a head start to where we are today.
So it's not just a question of when you're working on the scale, kind of maximizing surface area so that the sails can go into those pores. You also kind of want there to be a bit of balance where they're not too fine, where it's in the nanometer, as some other people
were doing. It's a niche that you need to find, and that's also a lot of research at the University of Eindhoven went into. Because you want your pores big enough for cells to grow in, but also not so big that they fly out on the other side, right? So I put it simple, but took some experiments to get there. But that is one of our unique understandings, that we have learned what that optimal niche is.
Mm. And how does that breakdown process look like? How long does it take for the implant to break down? And how does the body also get rid of these polymers? Because there's a lot of scares now around microplastics in our body and things like this. I'm curious how that works.
Oh, that's a fair question as well. So maybe first on microplastics. So microplastics, you read a lot about that these days. And these are basically plastics that have a certain chemistry that our body can't handle. So basically our body cannot digest or absorb those plastics, so they end up accumulating in all parts of your body, and people don't really realize that. How dangerous that is exactly, nobody knows exactly either, but just the idea is nobody likes that. So in our case, it's different. Our materials are specifically designed to bioabsorb. So we use chemistry that cells are able to break down. And the process for that is called oxidation. So the way the cells in our body work when they see a material that they recognize as, hey, this is not a body-owned material, they secrete certain signals, oxygen radicals, and that they then use to try and break down that material. And our material is designed to accommodate that. So in the end, our material breaks down to the molecular level, to a point that cells can simply assimilate the leftovers, and then you have nothing left.
Okay. And I mean, it's quite a unique approach compared to traditional implants.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, when you take this new approach, there has to be certain benefits to it compared to what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
So what are these benefits over the traditional implants?
Well, that's again a good question, and it really depends on the application that you are aiming for. As I mentioned, when we started, and that's also what the basis of the research at the University of Eindhoven was. The main goal was a heart valve for children. And the idea was when kids are born with a malformed or a deficient heart valve, they get a new one. But these new heart valves, they are not living materials. So kid gets older, gets bigger, and needs a new heart valve. So on average, these kids need 5-6 open heart surgeries before they reach kind of an adult size. So the idea of implanting something that is made of the patient's own cells, that has the ability to grow with the patient, that's a very appealing idea. So our belief was we can reduce the amount of reoperations if we do it like this. Mm. So that's a very, very obvious advantage. Now, with the blood vessels that we're making today, again, it depends a little bit on the application, but we make blood vessels for patients that need to undergo dialysis. So these are patients that have kidneys that don't work well or don't work at all. So they need to rely on the machine, a dialysis machine, to get their blood cleaned from all the waste products that you build up during the day. So those patients go to the hospital 3 times a week, and then they need to be connected to a dialysis machine. And for that, the current solution is most often, either connect two blood vessels in their arm directly to kind of create a local situation of where you have high blood flow, such that it takes less time for the machine to take out blood and then clean it and put it back in. Or you use a plastic blood vessel to connect the natural veins of the patient. So we are proposing the same, to use our plastic vessel to connect the patient's artery to the patient's vein. And the advantage of using an artificial vessel is that you can start a dialysis very quickly. But the disadvantage is that this is a foreign material, and if your material can't be absorbed, it remains a foreign material. And there are big needles going in that several times a week, so there's always a risk of infection. Because when you have a foreign material, bacteria like foreign materials, and this needle coming from outside, so that's a big problem with those. But they're still being used because the problem with the direct connection is that this direct connection takes a lot of time to, they call that, mature. When you connect a native artery to a native vein, this native vein gets much more flow, gets much higher pressure, and it can't handle that. It needs to get used to the new to the new environment. Yeah. And this can take easily half a year. And there are quite a lot of times it just never matures. So you never get to a point that you can actually use the access for dialysis. What we offer is the best of both worlds. We can start quickly because we start with an artificial vessel. But over time, our material becomes body-owned. So it becomes like the natural connection. And therefore, the risk of infection is much lower compared to the truly artificial grafts that are being used today.
Right.
So it really depends on the application, what the exact benefit is.
Yeah. And so you're seeing also then lower levels of rejection as well, I'm guessing, even when it's not just for dialysis, but for other blood vessels or maybe even the heart valves, because it's using the native cells.
Correct. So if you compare to, let's say, like a transplant from other patients, we don't need to worry about rejection, or there is no medication needed for that, because it's a simple material that gets filled by and transformed into the patient's own tissue.
So for researchers nowadays, they use organoids as well to test out medicines and stuff. But the problem is with keeping these alive for a long time, because you can't vascularize it. Is it possible to use your solution to vascularize these organoids to keep them alive longer? Is that a solution you've been looking into, or an application of the product you've been looking into?
No. Okay. That's a simple answer. No, so the one of the limitations in restoring tissue is the ability to vascularize, to let new, very small blood vessels, capillaries, grow into that material. We don't make that such small vessels. I mean, there is limitations to the diameters that we can achieve. But it is relevant in our field as well, because what we have shown is that our microstructure, this niche that I mentioned earlier, it is the pores are big enough to allow those capillaries, those very small vessels, to naturally grow into our material. That ensures that our material can really truly become a more natural tissue. So we kind of have the same problem as those organoids, but our microstructure solves that problem for us.
Okay, so Martin, we've heard a lot now about this pretty amazing technology that Celtis is developing. Are there maybe specific examples of how this has affected patient outcomes? Maybe, I'm not sure, but maybe a child has already gotten a valve implant, for example, and they haven't needed to go for multiple interventions. Are there stories that you can share around this by any chance?
Sure, yeah. Actually, we had cake at our company a few weeks ago to celebrate that we treated our 200th patient. So there are 200 patients out there that that received an implant from Celtis. I really believe we made a positive impact on their quality of life. Yeah. And among them are, our very first patient was a very, very cute little girl. Her name is Dominica. We actually did a photo shoot with her. You typically don't do that, but in this case, we got special permission from her and the hospital and her parents and everything. And that patient we treated more than a decade ago. And then maybe she was 6 or something then. And yeah, she's now a teenager. At some point, you can't follow these patients forever. The clinical trials take a certain time, in our case, 5 years. And after that, you need to be lucky to have an investigator that maybe, a doctor that keeps that contact. It can't go through a company anymore. So honestly, I don't know exactly how Dominica is doing, but I'm very much willing to believe that she's now somewhere out there becoming an adult herself, and that's an impact that we made.
So you've treated 200 people now. Mm-hmm. How do you select which ones at this stage of the company that you can treat or give these products to?
Well, that's an excellent question. So we have no products on the market. So we're still doing clinical trials. So patients that join our trials, they are aware that is not an approved product yet. But the way this goes is, you don't start with selecting patients. You start with selecting hospitals and doctors. You try to find a hospital and doctor that believes in your technology, that has experience with doing trials, that can show that they treat enough patients to let you. I mean, you don't want to work with a doctor and it takes 5 years before you have treated your first 5 patients. So there's a whole kind of battery of kind of things you need to check to say, okay, this is the hospital we're going to work with. And then there are also kind of selection criteria. And of course, you want to treat patients that are ill, that need a treatment. But what you don't want is that, let's say you treat a patient with your product, and then that patient dies for another reason. That can happen. That the patients we treat are pretty sick. Because even if it's not because of your product, there's still some burden of proof. It's not making it easier. So that's kind of a balancing act. In the beginning, you want to treat patients where you are sure enough that they will have a benefit from our product, and that they are not, but still that they are as healthy as possible. To put it in a sounds a bit weird, but in principle, that's what it comes down to. But then still, we never select the patients. We can put conditions, but in the end, the doctor says, okay, I found this patient, and we check together, do they meet the criteria? Then there are actually other doctors that decide, yes, the patient meets the criteria. And then the doctor speaks to the patient or the family of the patient and explains, okay, we have this concept, this new product. These are the risks. It's novel. We can't know everything. These are the potential benefits. And then the patient and or the parents need to make a very conscious decision. They sign a patient-informed consent form that they say, yes, we want to participate. And only then a patient gets selected. And then it can still be that the doctor, during the implant procedure, concludes, oh, wait a minute, this looks different than what we thought. Mm-hmm. Still not the best candidate, and they can still decide on the spot to implant a normal, truly artificial blood vessel, for example. Mm.
And how does the whole process go about finding these doctors? Is it a bit like investment where you get a lot of no's before you get a yes, or is it a lot more informed decision that you really go directly after the doctors you believe in first, and then they say yes quite quickly after you contact them?
Well, it is not unlike an investor selection process. But the difference is that, say, with investors, it's always the investor that says no. With doctors, you also, as a company, you want to be super selective. So you can have doctors that really want to join, but if you then look objectively, yeah, but they treat so few patients, that just doesn't work. So you need to be, I mean, with investors, you also need to be selective. But in the end, if they are showing you the money, you have to be in strong shoes to resist. With hospitals, you want to be very sure that they are committed, that they have the right experience, that they are treating the right patients. So you need to be, well, you want to be as selective as possible without taking years to find your doctors. So that's balancing act.
So you'd rather have a small selection of doctors that perfectly line up to what you need than having more doctors where half of them don't meet the perfect criteria for you?
Yes, and it also depends a bit on the stage you are at. So we are a medical device, so we don't have phase 1, 2, 3 clinical trials. What we typically have, you do a first-in-human trial where you treat maybe 10 patients, maybe 15, where you really show the safety of your product. And if that all looks fine, then you go to a bigger study where maybe you treat 100 or 150 patients, and then you get your market approval. For those 10 patients, you want to work with 2, 3, 4 sites that you know really well, that trust you, that you can trust. And then you find your perfect set of patients for those first 10. But we now recently completed enrollment, we call that. So we found all patients in such an approval study. So there we treated 120 patients with this dialysis graft. We're working with 23 hospitals. Across Europe. And not all of those hospitals implant a lot of patients. Actually, half of the patients come from less than a handful of those hospitals. But if you want to do such a big study, you have to work with a lot of centers, because you don't know exactly beforehand which one is going to be the one that gives you 25% of your cases. And they all say they're going to do that. And then you end up, then reality kicks in. So there you want, but sometimes it's also very important to, even that center that treated only one or two patients, if that is the only center in the UK or the only center in Germany that participated, it still means something if you can say, yeah, we also treated patients in the UK or in Germany or whatever. So then you're really looking for a mix. But you can imagine, maintaining a clinical study with 23 hospitals, even if it's only 120 patients, that's a pretty complex task.
Mm. How long did that take to get the 120 patients?
Let me think. I think that was two and a half years.
Okay.
And that's pretty fast, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, what I find really impressive about the story is that it's now 17, 18 years since the inception of Celtis. And it's taken to this point to get ready to go on the market.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of time that's needed for this to be achieved is monumental. I'm 26, so that's most of my life that it took to get to this point, essentially, for Celtis to become what it is. Like, how many of those changes, or how many changes have occurred among that time? Like, what are some key maybe pivot points in the journey of Celtis to get to this point where it's now ready to go to market, or soon?
Yeah. So I was 25 when I started Celtis, so I can relate to your question. Yeah. So what I would say when new people enter Celtis, they all everybody comes by me for a technology introduction. One of the things I always show to them is a statistic on our patients. So I start with a picture of Dominica, our first patient, and then I show a graph and I explain, look, the first 10 patients, the first 30 patients took about 8 years. The next 30 patients took 2 years. The next 50 patients took 1 year. And so at some point it takes off and things go faster. But it takes a long time before you get there. I think for us, the merger with Celtis was the first big step we had to make. Then later on, around the time, we made also the step to this technology where we implant a polymer and we don't kind of use the bioreactor anymore. The next big thing was when we decided to not only focus on heart valves, but also on blood vessels. And then there is more along the way. There are so many applications we can work on. Which ones to choose or to not choose or to pause and pick up later on? That's a constant kind of balancing act. They always say, you're a startup, you need to focus. But if you had done that, then we would no longer exist. And then, because then at some point, with the kind of work we do, you on one application, you hit a wall. And if that's your only application, then you don't have time to figure out how to go through the wall or above the wall or around the wall. So then you're stuck. Now, we had the kind of the luxury, complex luxury of, okay, we hit the wall here, but we still have this program. So we can still continue the other program. And that helped us a lot. And so now today we have three products that are in clinical trials. Our dialysis access graft is further along. But each of those products was the flagship at some point in the company. And today it's the dialysis graft, and it could not have become our flagship of today if we didn't have the other flagships at some point as well.
To lean on them and have that be your focus. Yeah. Fair enough. And how has it been for you, actually? Because as far as we could tell from our research, you went from studying into your PhD and your PhD into Celta. So it's been essentially your company, or the one that you co-founded, has essentially been the only company that you've really worked for.
Correct.
And also in a very niche application, if you look at the broad spectrum of what's possible for people to do with work. So how has that been for you? Because it's 17 or 18 years now of working on this, I guess, maybe not so specific problem, because you had the luxury of taking these different tracks, but it is always a similar application. So how's that been for you?
Oh, that's a good question. What I sometimes answer is, okay, if I would have known when I started that this would take 18 years, I might not have started. But now I know, and now I'm glad that I started, right? People told me, this takes 15, 20 years. And I thought, I have never done this before. I'm sure I can do this faster. I mean, you need to have a little bit of this naiveness to you to keep the motivation going. But but let's say I studied at the University of Eindhoven and did my PhD research there, and I moved straight on from that into Celtis, which is still based on the University of Eindhoven campus. So I never really left that square mile. So you could say, that's pretty narrow. And it sounds a bit scary saying that I started there in 1999 and now it's 2025. But on the other hand, the journey took me to all kinds of places. From founding a super small company, and in the beginning, you're the only people there, so you do everything from getting the mail and arranging the pension plan and I don't know what, all that kind of stuff. And then over time, the team grows. You bring in people that know much more on topics that you know less of. And that's a big tip. Always do that. And then your role changes. And actually, my role now is way more technical than it was when we just started. I'm not the science, maybe not, but the technology and the mechanisms, that's a bigger focus for me now than it was maybe even when I was doing my my PhD in a way. But there is a whole company around it that is on a daily basis producing implants for real patients. So sometimes there is things that I think, I think I saw this before a few years ago already. So there is some history repeats itself a bit. But on the other hand, seeing the progress that we make and having cake because you just treated your patient number 200, that's also very rewarding. So I'm not bored yet.
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, it also sounds like you've had so many different paths and angles to look at this project. Also, the project was never always the same. So there's always something that you can learn from these different phases. Yeah. And I think what's impressive, we haven't mentioned it yet because it's not per se the sole focus, but Celtis has raised over 160 million euros in funding, if I'm not mistaken, which is a obscene amount of funding, to be frank. So it's also, for me, what's interesting for my personal angle is that you can build a company for this amount of time. You're not even on the market yet. You've received this amount of funding, while the advice that I think our generation of entrepreneurs gets is just start and do whatever and go very quickly, which I think there's a lot of worthy wisdom in that advice. But this is such a different story than the ones that we usually see, or the way that we've had our own experiences with our own companies, that it's quite cool to see that it worked out like this as well.
Yeah, I think in the field of medical devices or in medication and in pharmaceuticals, this is very typical. Mm. Into say what's happening more and more, that maybe earlier, let's say 10, 20 years ago, you wouldn't need to bring a company until market approval before a big company would come and would acquire and would kind of take care of that themselves. That doesn't happen anymore. Basically, let's say all the bigger players that are already in the market, they become more and more risk avoiding. So they want you to hash out all the risks and really bring a product to market approval. And then they are interested in adding your product to their portfolio. And I'm not saying that that is kind of the only path for a company like Celtis. That's what you see very often. That at some point, we have investors, they want a return on their investment. And then finding a strategic partner that is already active in the market that you're developing in and already has a worldwide kind of scale and commercial network and everything, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, for me as a founder, the idea of using such a global commercial workforce to reach as many patients as possible, I find that an appealing idea as well. So you work towards that, but if you first need to reach CE approval or maybe even FDA approval, it costs a lot of money. So yeah, then there you go.
Yeah.
So you mentioned selling the company to a bigger company, so companies buying it and then putting it into the portfolio. Is that the ultimate goal as well with Celtis, to have an exit like that once you're approved? Or do you want to really run this company yourself for a while before you start thinking about exits?
No, that's a good question. And the answer is, in a way, it doesn't matter, because you need to plan for both anyway. Right, because even, of course, we have investors that have a certain investment horizon and they want to get their money back, and they want a profit on top, and they should. And for them, the most logical option is selling the company or making some kind of license deal or whatever to an existing player. But you can't plan on that. I mean, you don't know if that happens, if there is a good match, if the market, with all the volatility in the markets these days, who is there to say that the markets are good for something like that in a year or 2 years from now? So you just need to move ahead and plan for the idea that you will commercialize yourselves, and we can. You can do that. And then you see what happens along the way, whether the circumstances are right for something else or not.
So throughout getting funding as well for the company, I wanted to ask this for a while. Is it difficult sometimes to convince investors to invest when the horizon is this long? Because for Unshackle, when we're talking to investors, it's we want to have an exit in 6 to 7 years, or some people say we want to have our money back within 5 years. But here you're talking 17, 18 years, maybe even longer before you're on the market and you start making money in the company. Are you just dealing with investors that already know this is what happens, so they're just used to it? Or do you really have to convince some of them to get on board for that horizon?
Well, let's put it this way. Our first business plan wasn't assuming it would take 18 years. No, I mean, let's say we do have investors that are familiar with the space and that know how long things take and can take. And they know that there are typically delays compared to initial plans. But when you are seeking investment, you need to make sure that your proposition is investable. So you should have a very clear idea on how much money you want, how far that is going to get you, and what value inflection points you will reach with that money. As if you can't make the case that, okay, this is the amount of money we need, and we're going to go do this and this, and then we achieve those milestones, and therefore your value will be more than what you put in, and then you don't get any money. So it's not per se that they want to see, the end game, but they want to see, okay, either there is a potential for an exit, or there is a value increase which allows the next round that is at a higher valuation. That always needs to be clear, and then you, by showing that you can execute on what you promised, you become a more trustworthy investment, and it's more likely that the existing investors want to do another round. They always want to do a new investor to be there as well, but it helps if your existing investors are willing to continue.
And just to get an idea, as someone who likes to focus on the people and organizations, how many people did you start with originally in the QTIS team, and how many people are in Xeltis today?
Yeah, so we started with two. So it was me and another PhD student that we said, okay, let's do this. So we were the founding management team of QTIS. And then we had two lab technicians from University of Eindhoven that were part-time and later full-time, kind of doing the actual manufacturing of our living heart valves back in the day. And that team, we grew until about 12 people around the time that we merged with Xeltis. And when we merged, we became 20-something. And so we were kind of, in terms of people, was a merger of equals. And since then, we had a bit of up and down. But today, we are in the up, and we are 60-something people.
It's quite a big team as well.
Yeah.
And then how does that look if you guys get market approval? What are the plans for that phase once you have ticked that box? I'm guessing since it's been a long road to get there, you already have ideas of how to continue.
Yeah, sure. So we still work on multiple applications. Or the dialysis access graft, I mentioned this. We are closest to market approval. If things go well this year, then we can submit. So we can ask for CE approval towards the end of the year. You never know exactly how long that process takes, but normally that should lead to market approval somewhere next year. And then we are now thinking of a plan. Okay, how can we indeed start a sales in a most meaningful way without kind of building a 60-plus person global sales team? We need to be a bit smart in how we can do this in an efficient way and then reach a relevant turnover, but with a focused smaller team. At the same time, We have the next application, the next application that is a bit earlier on in the earlier phase of clinical trials that we want to bring to that same point. So it's also a little bit kind of a factory that is pulling out additional applications to show the full breadth, the full value of the technology platform that we represent. And we will take each of those as far as it takes. And how far that is exactly, we don't know exactly.
Just like at the beginning. But then how do you foresee any changes to your role once you go to market? Will there be changes in maybe your day-to-day as head of technology?
That's a good question, and I don't know. Let's say for every application, there is a there is a technology foundation. There is questions that that need to be answered. Questions from regulators like the FDA or the notified bodies in Europe. They want to be very sure that we know how our product works and how it's in the body, how it gets absorbed and replaced by natural tissue, and that there is nothing funky happening along the way. And since we have a novel product, nobody knows exactly how to measure that and how to ensure that. So it's my task to figure out how to do that and how to bring that across. So that is not over, but probably with every new application, there is more information you can leverage from the previous one. So it should be a bit less complicated. So I don't know. I like that part of my job. So I expect I will continue to like that. And if I start liking it less, then we'll see then, right? I never saw a lot of value in thinking ahead too much on things that I can't, that are out of my control anyway. So as long as I enjoy the challenge of what I'm doing, and I'm in the right place.
Very fair. And you're enjoying it?
I am, yeah.
Good.
Good.
So we have this closing tradition on the podcast where we ask our guests to bring an object that has a significant meaning in their personal or professional life. What did you bring for us today?
Indeed. So I was aware of this tradition. And when I was thinking of what to bring, I got this... I was thinking of these videos that my kids sometimes watch where they do these unwrapping videos. And when I was taking this with me, I thought, maybe we can do that on a podcast as well. I don't know how well this comes across in audio, but I have here something that we still need to unwrap. So I have here a little box. There was all kinds of stickers on it, and actually it's what I never realized when I started the company, how much effort actually goes into designing the right packaging for a medical device. I mean, it's not like there is some random words on there. Every single sentence has a research project behind it that we researched. Okay, do we indeed have the right evidence to state what we are stating on this product? So I'm spoiling it a little bit. This is the packaging of one of our products. It's our pulmonary valved conduit. So it's a heart valve for kids that are born with some kind of problem with their heart valve. And the outer box, it looks like a simple paper box, but there's already all kinds of warnings with a story behind them. And then if we open that, I guess this makes all kinds of funny sounds when you hear it in the podcast later on. You get to the next layer of the packaging. This is an aluminum foil pouch. And that pouch is there to provide a sterile barrier. And so that when the, basically, let's say, when this enters the surgical field where the patient needs to be implanted, that we make sure we put the thing on there in a sterile way. And I have to say it's a while since I opened the package, but the idea is that you kind of open it like this, and then you get to drop your package on the sterile field. And now I realize this is actually a very old one, because by now we have a blister package as the internal packaging that has the exact size of the product that we have developed. But this one is still a relatively simple plastic jar. It has all kinds of signals on there as well. So this plastic jar, well, I already contaminated it because I am. I guess you didn't sterilize your table beforehand either. But still inside is the product. So I'll open that. This one was an expired one, so there's no, you're not wasting any patient's implants here. And then we get to the actual product, and that's a pulmonary heart valve. So this is made of our electrospun polymer. You see it's all in one piece. There is actually, we make it in four pieces, but we have a secret way of gluing them together. So it's a tube. And it has three leaflets inside that make it into a valved conduit. And this is what we have used to, what we have implanted in patients maybe around 4 to 6 years old that needed a new heart valve. And these heart valves were already a topic of research when I was doing my PhD research, actually even before when I was studying biomedical engineering. And people asked me, okay, what do you do as a biomedical engineer? And I would say, yeah, for example, you make a heart valve that grows with a patient. Oh, wow. So that was one of the reasons that I ended up doing that research. And to get to the point that we kind of retreated our first patients with this heart valve, and I'll never forget that moment in my life. Because on the one hand, super, super rewarding. It's also super scary. Like the idea that you have made something, a heart valve that goes into a patient. You have this instinct that, no, it can't be perfect. I mean, you need to make it better. You need to even make it even better. We need to, right, you it has to be perfect. But perfect is the enemy of finished or done or whatever. At some point, you just need to say, look, we did all the safety precautions. We don't know everything yet, but we know everything we can reasonably know. And if you want to help patients, we need to get started. And that's what we did. And and that worked out well. And it's not our flagship anymore, but still the one that is dearest to me, because that's actually what my research was all about.
Wow.
I always find it crazy to look at that piece and then think about how much research went in to get to that.
Yeah, you shouldn't think about that.
It's a lot of work to get to that part that then works. Correct, inside of a human body.
Yeah,
that's
true.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a very stupid way of thinking about it, but if I go on vacation and I'm leaving the house, I double check keys, wallet, phone, my bag, everything I have, trying to make sure that I didn't forget the one stupid thing that I would notice in 3 days, aka it wasn't even that important. And now I can imagine that with this and it going into a patient's body, it's that same emotion, but times 100,000.
It's the unknown unknowns.
Exactly.
that you can't plan for. You can just kind of make the chance that they happen as small as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Commendable. Very cool.
Thank you.
Very, very cool. Can I touch
you? Sure.
Thanks. It feels different than I thought it would.
It feels almost like a little bit of a foamy texture.
Well, that's what it is a bit. Huh? It's made from one single continuous fiber that has a diameter less than a hair. But it's very porous, so there is indeed lots of openings in between those fibers. Sometimes people, it feels like a paper straw. It feels a bit disrespectful for the hard work that goes behind it. But I see why people make that association.
Crazy.
It's very cool.
It's insane to think that everything grows around this in a way where this can become a fully functioning heart valve.
Well, it's a fully functioning heart valve from the second we implant it.
Fair.
And it remains that while the material gets replaced by natural tissue. It's kind of changing the engine of the car while it's running.
How long does it take for the tissue to grow around this?
Well, that's a good question. So that depends a bit on the application again.
Mm-hmm.
So for blood vessels, we know that within a few months, there is sufficient tissue around to ensure functionality.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say within a year or so, the material has lost its strength. So it's taken over by natural tissue. For the heart valve, and especially for the tip of the cusp that you see in the middle, this takes longer. Mm-hmm. Tissue needs to grow from the base towards the tip. And that just takes more time.
Martijn, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on today and sharing a pretty awe-inspiring story of two people building it to a company that it is today with now 60 and doing some really cool, innovative work that will hopefully, and already is, changing lives. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode of First Moves. If you want to connect with our guests personally, make sure to follow us on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram called First Moves Podcast. And lastly, if you could take a moment to leave a review, it helps us make the show better for you, but also helps us get even better and more insightful guests over the long run. Thank you very much and have a great day.